So I'm Brett Bellington. I'm leading this panel. I don't know exactly why, because I haven't worked in a big company in a long time, but I'm doing it. So the discussion point we're having today is working in a big company versus a startup. Can you be entrepreneurial in either case? When in your career? So we have on our panel here today, we have someone who's just trying to do this now because he sold his company to Nokia. Now he's moving from San Francisco to Berlin. Maybe moving to Berlin, he says, I know. You never know with these big companies, they could ship you all over the world. And our esteemed group from Google. Did either one of you guys work in small companies first?
Yes.
Oh, good. So you guys can talk about that. Yeah. So why don't you guys talk about, from your perspective, the Google perspective, working small companies and big companies?
Well, I founded my own business, which was obviously a very, very small company to begin with, and then grew into a bigger company. But sold it, or at least I sold my stake in it, three and a half, four years ago. And was looking around for a similar thing to build or to buy. And then someone said, go work for Google, because it's really entrepreneurial. And so I thought, okay. And I gave it a go. And I'd never expected to still be here now, 3.5 years later, precisely because I didn't see myself working in a very big company for very long. The fact that I'm still here speaks to the fact that there, you know, one can satisfy many entrepreneurial urges whilst working for, certainly working for Google, and I'm sure this is true of other big companies, but by no means all. And I'm sure we can talk about that in more detail.
And my experience is similar. I founded my own company and unfortunately didn't get acquired by Google, so that I didn't have the experience of getting integrated in that way. Ended up working at a couple places before Google, Viacom, and then Google. But the differences are stark in certain instances, in that obviously you're dealing with a sheer scale of a lot more people. My own business was not 20,000 people, so there's a lot more process. But there's also in certain instances a lot more creativity because of the mind share that 20,000 people, 20,000 good people, hopefully, can bring to the table. And I think Google, as an organization, it does a great job in certain roles and functions of innovating and allowing creative freedoms, particularly from the engineers on the technology side. Less so from the business side, but there is a mindset of entrepreneurship within the company. Hence, I think they hire a lot of people like Rob and myself that have been entrepreneurs that don't need to be managed and can create from within the corporate structure.
So, Hans-Peter, why don't you talk about your recent experience? Even though he's only been at Nokia for a few months now, right?
Yeah. So I'd say this is probably the first time in my adult life that I've been, and I guess I consider that anything later than 30 or something, that I've been working for a large company. And I made a very deliberate choice to do this and to structure things so that I would, you know, have an interesting role to play in the company that acquired us. But let me share a few thoughts, observations on it. So first off, I think if the core question, can you be entrepreneurial, is very much dependent on culture and very even within an organization, depending on where you are. So I think depending on which group acquires you and like who your boss is ultimately and what the sort of that has a fair amount to do with it, especially in more traditional organizations. You will probably find people who are at Nokia who say, no, it's not very entrepreneurial, and you'll find people who will say it's wildly entrepreneurial, and it, you know, they work for the same 110,000 person company. But for me, the decision was actually one of Nokia is going through a lot of change, and it's been a hugely successful company for the last 20, 25 years, and of course has a much longer history than that, but in the mobile space, and is now finding itself, you know, with the changing landscape. And so the opportunity for me in this, what happened, was to enter a corporation that is recognizing that it needs some change and it needs to do things in different ways, and recognizing that also allowing change to happen. Now, when you allow change to happen, it's kind of like, you know, some organism enters your body and starts telling your body that it, you know, needs to somehow behave differently, and your body's going to try to reject it, right? There's going to be sort of a new DNA coming in to sort of try to change the way you behave and operate. Well, you've seen those sci-fi movies, right? It looks kind of like this. I think big companies that try to inject change have a similar can have a similar reaction. So the challenge if you're coming in and trying to be entrepreneurial is, I think, to first off start with a recognition of the value that exists. You know, not, you know, I think the most dangerous thing and the most thing I see the most with startups is they come in very arrogant. It's like, well, we understand, we know how to do it. It's like, reminder, you're 15 people, and yeah, you created some cool software, but you know, you haven't quite done the $73 billion thing yet that we've done. And I think having some respect for that and actually looking at it as a learning opportunity, it's like, how did they do that? How did they build a $73 billion global corporation that sends, that now sells, you know, 400 million of these things every year? I mean, that's astonishing, right? But at the same time, as the industry shifts, you need to be able to change the way that business is being done. And that is a huge opportunity, hugely entrepreneurial, but also hugely scary, because there are a lot of people who, you know, their bonuses, their paychecks depend on shipping 400 million of those. So if you want to change any of the parameters that might actually impact that, you're going to be a threat as well. So I describe it as a sociology experiment. It's a hugely interesting experience and experiment that we're getting to run. And you know, 12 months from now, we'll either be very successful and it'll be quite interesting, or we'll be rejected because maybe we pushed too hard or we just failed within the organization.
And so I before this panel, last couple of weeks, I actually surveyed people that were in companies that I was funded and startups and sold. Some of Google bought some, Yahoo bought some, and so forth. I asked them, now that they're in large companies, or a lot of them have actually left the larger companies and are doing other companies, can you really be entrepreneurial in a large company? And overwhelmingly, I got a response back was no. Right? And the main reason that it was no was because once they got into the comfort zone of a larger company, they ended up with these creature comforts of, you know, you could do these things, you know, you didn't have to take the, if you didn't make this decision or this didn't work right, you might, you know, you might fail. Or they had the creature comforts that always sit there. And as a result, the people that get associated with those products sometimes weren't people, because they expand the team or they move people around in some of these teams, that it becomes challenging to do it. Google actually is one of the few ones that is kind of interesting this way, because I also think what Google does before they, when they buy a company and bring them in on board, they interview every employee, like pretty much every employee. And figure out which ones they want. And they'll actually tell you when you're going to bring the people into the company, they're going to say, we don't want these 25% of your staff, and you have to deal with them to get rid of them or something like that. You'll deal with them before the deal is going to happen. And they also will take people who are CEOs of companies and say, you're going to be now a director, because there's not that many VPs within Google. And they're able to bring these people in and get them to be in those roles. But still in the Google environment, it's still a very controlled decision-making environment. And that a lot of decisions are made by a very few people at the top, and the organization is structured in a way to make that sort of a self-reinforcing habit. So the trick is, you can get frustrated in it, but at the same time, they give you incredible latitude. So of a large company, they're one of the few ones that I think that of all the people I talked to felt that it could occur in. But the big thing is that you have the trappings of, once you get into a large company, you have the trappings of the support infrastructure, and the risks that you're taking are just different, you know, than they are the risk when you're in a really small entrepreneurial kind of company. So I think that's a key thing. I think more and more companies are trying to solve this problem. You're really seeing it in large media companies, but it's challenging. Well, you probably can see this in the media companies you work in with those as partners. And they're stuck in a lot of old world to a new world, having a hard time making that transition forward, particularly in the United States. Maybe some of the ones over here are doing a better job of it. So I think that's the basis. Do we have any questions? And let's get into some questions relatively quickly, because I feel some of my sessions before we didn't get into the questions quickly. You need a mic, though. Where's our mic guy? We have to do the mic thing. What we might want to try to do is think of it, if you have questions going from here to this way, so the mic guy, well, he might need to lose a few pounds. So maybe it'd be good to have him running around.
It's not so loud.
Well, I'd like to ask about the last question, the title. When in your career did you do any internships when you were at university? You know, did you dream or wanted to come, you know, work for big investment banks or consultancies who could kind of give you the skill sets that you think are important to a businessman or to somebody who wants to be successful?
You know, I'll tell you how I ended up in the computer business. It's really random. I paid my way through college as a machinist. So I worked in a machine shop every summer. And I graduated from college, and I moved to Berkeley because my girlfriend lived in Berkeley. And there was a small little computer company that manufactured some products, but they changed their design, and they needed to be fixed. And they needed someone who had my background to help them do that. So I got a degree in political science, knew nothing about technology, but knew how to do all the stuff they needed to do. So for a couple months, I just did this part-time temporary job. And every day, because this product actually was very critical to this company, and they had to get this done relatively fast, I did it, something that they thought was going to take 3 months. We did it in about a month and a half. And every day, the CEO of the company would come out and sit next to me and go, "How are you doing today? And how are you doing today?" And at the end of it, he said, "You know, we like you. Why don't you stay?" And I just fell into the computer industry kind of in a very random kind of way. But now what I do is I spend a reasonable amount of time mentoring like college students. I've helped some students out of Stanford. In fact, particularly I've helped some women out of Stanford women's soccer team get intern jobs and so forth, because in the U.S., you know, in colleges, there's a lot of sports involved in colleges, and a lot of the people play athletes. They're athletes. They do it. It's like a professional career through their entire college career. By the time they get out, they don't know what they're going to do because they didn't have these internships. But it's interesting sitting down and kind of, what I try to do now is kind of sit down with people and kind of go, when you're done, what do you want to learn? Like in the summer, so your summer's over, what do you want to learn? What kind of company you want to be involved with? What kind of people do you want to learn from? Because I think when you're going to college, a lot of it is trying to be, you're sucking a lot of knowledge out of people. You're trying to figure out what things you want to learn. So when it's all said and done, that you have one summer you're doing something, the next summer you might be doing some, next summer you're doing something else. Now that leads to this collective body of knowledge with your school that you can effectively say, how do you apply that when you get out of school? I think a lot of it is you have to dig down and kind of figure out what you want to learn. And some of that is just having discussions with a lot of people. Well, you know, like now, thinking I'm doing an internship next summer, now thinking about what are all the potential opportunities so you can begin lining that up now. Even though I will admit today, in today's world, it's much harder because there's a lot more competition, because there are people who have already graduated that will do work at companies for free because they're having a hard time getting a job.
One way of looking at the problem of when to, you know, when to make the kind of entrepreneurial call, when to make a big company call in your career, to your question, is to look at your. I'm talking in general. Of course, everyone has their own particular their own particularities, but in general, your risk profile, your changes fairly predictably over time for most people, which is to say that when you start out in life, people are in a position to take much greater risks because you have no, you're pretty free and you're kind of used to, you know, living on pretty much squalor. At least I did as a student, and so, you know, what's the downside, right? And then, you know, people tend to kind of get married and have kids and just get older and just become a bit less imaginative and grayer. So when people ask themselves a question like, you know, should I go off and start a business? And then they think, well, maybe the time isn't right. The probability is the time is more right when they ask that question than 6 months later, and it's probably more right then than 6 months after that, in general. Okay? The trouble is that when you're just starting out in life, you know absolutely nothing. You're like, you know, you're really not in a position to actually bring a huge amount of value to a business just because you've got absolutely no experience, right? And kind of the value you can bring, again, in general, I'm really generalizing here, increases over time, right? So your risk become more and more conservative over time, but you actually know a hell of a lot more stuff over time. So I think that's kind of, to my mind, is a challenge. How one weighs those, to my mind, should always be in favor of, you should always be focusing on risk rather than knowledge. Because ultimately, you know, there's never a better time to start your own business if that's what you want to do than right now, in general. So if you're thinking about it, do it, because in 6 months' time, there'll be other reasons why you don't want to do it, or you'll have less of an impulse to do it. That would be my general advice.
I think I would just add, I think it's very good to have a mix. If you were to fast forward 10 years and look back, I think a mix of both is probably something I would have done a little bit differently looking back, because I think you learn. I mean, if you're doing a startup, you have to work with the big guys, the big companies, and there's nothing like having, you know, done a 10-year internally in a big company to just understand the sales process, understand the budgeting process, understand the motivational stuff you're dealing with. All that stuff, if you're coming in blind from the outside, you know, your solution might make complete intuitive sense to you, but it doesn't make organizational and structural sense, and you don't understand why because you haven't lived and experienced that. So I think living that, I mean, I worked at Apple early in my career. I worked at CERN, the Center for European Nuclear Research here in Europe. I had kind of a variety of interesting, and I worked at McKinsey for a while, and a variety of kind of interesting mixes, but essentially I always kept going back to entrepreneurship and startups. And I think at this stage, you know, now even with the short stint I've had internally, and it's, you know, it's a completely fascinating opportunity to me, but as I'm looking internally, I'm seeing things every day that's kind of like, oh, right, you know, I'm getting it. I'm putting the pieces together. And this is, you know, relative to you, late in my career, right? I've been at it for 20 years. And so I think if I'd had a few of those experiences a little bit earlier, maybe, but then again, maybe if I'd entered in at the stage, at the level I enter in at, I wouldn't have quite seen the connections I can see today. So I would say the headline is mix and match a little bit, go back and forth. And but the risk piece is obviously a key personal decision criteria as well.
I would pick up on that point as well. I think that both as an entrepreneur and in a big company, I've learned very different yet complementary pieces which make up the knowledge that I have right now, which I can apply in some way, hopefully in a useful way. So I think they're both valuable, and you can be entrepreneurial in a big company if you have that mentality. I think it's if you have that burning desire to be entrepreneurial, even within a big company, you will do something, whether it's start a new product, whether it's work with a new business unit, whether, you know, take an existing product to a new market. And I think a good organization will see that within you, that is your strength and your skill, and will help you build that out in your own career. My personal background, I started out my career in investment banking, quite stable, you know, had a very clear path towards a white picket fence and a big house and a fat bank account, and it wasn't for me. So I saw opportunities in the tech industry and the media industry that I wanted to exploit, and I wanted to do it myself, partially with the ignorant/arrogant attitude, thinking that I could do it better than somebody else, but that's maybe the attitude that you need and the desire that you need to go and make change and actually create something.
More questions?
Thank you.
You know, should ask if there are more questions. The question before the last response, so that they can pass the mic.
Yeah, we'll get around.
Hello, gentlemen. Bryn Williams.
Process optimization.
Could you give us some leading indicators as to how to select from large companies, as to those companies and company cultures which are more welcoming to entrepreneurs and corporate ventures, and some of those indicators which might be warning flags to individuals considering to go into them in terms of giving the latitude for entrepreneurship?
Can I take that? Speak to people within those organizations. There's no substitute for that. No amount of, you know, corporate, you know, collateral on websites is going to give you the answer.
Yeah. Use your network. Yeah. I mean, it's basically the same thing. You know, go into, look at, you can use LinkedIn, use, you know, Google, use Facebook, use whatever is your way of collecting knowledge and trying to reach out. And I think the other thing is be really frank about it. Kind of go, we're thinking about, I'm thinking about doing this. Don't ask it kindly. And I would really be aggressive in terms of your questioning and sort of netting it out.
Are there some activities in terms of corporate behaviors which are positive signals, though, in terms of being warm and receptive to internal entrepreneurs and so much of warning signs?
So on high growth companies tend to be more entrepreneurial, just by definition. You can kind of figure out which are high growth companies or which the market thinks are high growth companies just by looking at multiples. I mean, there's lots of kind of proxies, but I mean, the reality is if you're looking to join a particular sector, you know, you ought to be completely familiar with all of the players that you're considering joining. And I think, you know, as I say, there's no substitute for speaking to people on the ground.
And there are examples of some larger companies that are going through huge. I mean, I think most major media companies are going through a huge transition, and that I mean, some of these are just not going to make it through the transition, and some of them will. It's not more the ones that are trying to inject some entrepreneurialism, like Richard Titus is probably doing this at at Associated Northcliffe, mm-hmm. and you know he's kind of a quirky, he's a really highly entertaining guy, and he's trying to create a whole new buzz within what that company's doing. It'll be they've done some very interesting stuff as a company actually, but I think they're going to start doing more if they can be successful at it.
But just a quick reality check. I mean, this goes to your point earlier. You know, working in a big company is not an entrepreneurial activity. It just isn't, right? I mean, ultimately, you know, these are kind of proxies. You know, you can get to approximations. You can satisfy certain aspects of being an entrepreneur. But to my mind, the defining characteristic of being an entrepreneur is operating under conditions of radical uncertainty. When I mean radical uncertainty, what I mean is that uncertainty is the defining fact of your life as an entrepreneur. And that's not true of working at Google.
Yep. I mean, there's situations as a board member, an investor in companies, and I work very closely with the companies I work with, where, you know, a company might have a business deal that goes down and we think that we might have to shut the company down in 60 days and what are we going to do about it? Yeah. You know, and sometimes you have to go and inspire people to kind of go, no, there's a whole bunch of other opportunities. And how do we find out what that opportunity is? And that you won't see that at a larger company. The other thing I think is interesting about what I find having done a lot of small companies or being involved with them, it gets addictive. You know, you kind of love that fear, that uncertainty, that doubt, and it's now it's good from my perspective. I'm an investor and board member that I'm not living it on a day-to-day basis, but it's part of my value I bring. Since I'm not living it, I can sort of help them think about things differently. But I also think it's what's funny to me is when I go back when I joined the Excite team a long time ago, it was like, you know, one of the founders' moms, this guy Graham Spencer, works at Google now. You know, he turned down a job to go work at Apple, and he, like Apple and Microsoft, all these guys want to hire him, and he told his mom he's going to start a company, and she goes, you idiot, what are you doing that for, right? This is Apple, and this is Microsoft. Why would you do that, right? And he's become a very successful
although entrepreneur. If he'd gotten options in Apple back then, he'd probably have been just as well off.
Yeah, right? But he had to have to survive all that infrastructure. and then at one point in time, the Excite before it was in public, was we had an offer, Microsoft offered to buy the company for $75 million in cash. And, you know, we turned it down. We went public. The company was worth a couple hundred million dollars when we went public. And then within, like, a year later, it was worth $62 million. And his mom called him up again and said, you idiot, you know? And then we sold the company at home for $6.5 billion. But, you know, that happened, like, 4 years later. So the thing is, you have to – this whole roller coaster ride up and down, you got to be prepared to ride that roller coaster. But to me, it's really – you learn a lot about yourself. You find you're working with a lot of different people with different experiences. You can find people have got a tremendous amount of experience. Their experience is useless, and it's actually a problem in helping. And so you got to find you're driving and developing new things. It's really, to me, it's a lot of fun. But you have to be a person who can really want to do that.
You know, one interesting point as well is in a large company, there is a competitive ecosystem just like there is in the marketplace. So when you know you can be in Silicon, I told my team this when we did the acquisition. It's like, look, you've been competing with Nats like us, right? We've been competing in the marketplace of ideas called Silicon Valley. Now we're competing similarly. I mean, I enter this corporation and I realize that pretty much any piece of work we'd done, there were some kind of competitive overlapping technology somewhere in the organization, right? And it ranged from, you know, a little village in Finland to, you know, to Vancouver, to, you know, all over the place. And in fact, I just did an architecture diagram where I mapped physical locations to the efforts that we kind of have brought to the table. And there are now 6 physical locations worldwide that are doing things kind of very similar that we're now consolidating and sort of streamlining. Point is that the ecosystem is just different. It's still a competitive ecosystem where you have to survive through entrepreneurial activities, through clever strategic thinking and business planning, and through team building, and you know, maybe your PR agent isn't towards, you know, the New York Times anymore. It's towards the internal teams within the company, getting your message out, getting your plan, your leadership kind of established so that people will start following you. And it's a very similar dynamic, but just it's a very different dynamic, but a similar kind of ultimately similar ecosystem.
More questions?
We have one right here.
Oh, right here. Sorry.
Yeah, just coming back to the point that you said, being entrepreneurial is being like acting in uncertainty, right? Mm-hmm. What would you say on the when a company grows, and I mean we have all the examples like Twitter and so on, is there like a tipping point where you would say a company turns from being entrepreneurial to being just a large company?
Yes, sure.
And where is it?
It's the law of gravity. Sorry, that's a million-dollar question. Identifying exactly when that happens, I don't think.
No, but, like, are there some indicators where you would say you could apply this to measure?
I think the day that you take a company public, that's a good indication that you're probably going to have a whole new set of stakeholders, and probably it's going to change your risk profile. Albeit, you may still have entrepreneurial notions, but you're not going to be the same sort of entrepreneurial business. Even to that end, I think, I don't know, maybe I defer to you on this, but when you take on VC money, your risk profile changes all of a sudden because you have a new set of stakeholders. So I think it's not one point in the growth of an organization. There's many points within that entire lifespan that would change.
Yeah, in some ways you could argue that bigger companies allow for kind of more flexibility, like a Google or a Nokia, because once if you're doing a startup, in my experience, having done a number of them now, is that you can only be entrepreneurial until you actually figure out what you're doing. And then you actually have to sort of switch gears quite entirely and be very operationally focused and try to scale the business. And so the entrepreneurial thing is kind of a luxury you have while you're chasing your tail trying to figure out what you're doing, and then you switch. And then you can actually be entrepreneurial again for quite some, but I'm exaggerating here, but you get into a mode where it's very operationally focused. And, you know, I heard Biz mention this earlier, and we've all seen, you know, Twitter stood still as far as features, functionality, all that kind of stuff for 2 years. Why? Because they were so freaking successful, right? All they could do was back in on the back room with duct tape trying to get the servers to scale and trying to get the infrastructure to scale. And now that they had a huge capital infusion and can actually sort of hire people to take care of that problem, you're starting to see innovation and entrepreneurship, or innovation at least, happening at the product front again. Now, they were entrepreneurial in the way they were in the market, the way they were doing business, but from a product perspective, they didn't do anything for 2 years, which is a very common thing. You find the thing you want to do, and then the good guys, and look at Google. It's a freaking little box on a screen that you type into, right? Now, it took a long time before it turned into anything else. Today, it's obviously a suite of much, but that was the thing they executed on for years in order to create the business that now funds all that other fun stuff you see.
Question.
Just listening to the panel, like I kind of hear about the roller coaster and about comfort and about uncertainty and about this alien organism that comes in, and it strikes me that there's something really essential about adopting and loving each one of those experiences in order to be an entrepreneur. But I just wondered if the panel could offer any advice for the kind of behaviours a company, a small company, or an individual might adopt to get good at that, to make the best of it, I guess.
I think one of the things you want to do, and actually Biz talked about this, and actually Google's done this a lot, but you're seeing, is just be transparent. Blake from Slingbox earlier talked about it, is the idea is just being transparent. It's really hard doing these companies. It's not an easy thing to do. People think, oh, I'm going to start this company. And what I love about naive, young and entrepreneurs is that they don't know. Right? That's what's great about them, right? They come in and they're going to go, yeah, we're going to do this. We're going to build this huge thing. And people go, no, you're not. But they, you know, you can do it. And that naiveness sometimes is like the power, and why you see a lot of people that are extremely young. Look at Zuckerberg, right? You know, he thinks he can be a CEO of what soon is, well, probably by the end of next year, at least over $1 billion company. And so you look at that and you go, or Larry and Sergey, even though they got to the point where they had to bring Eric Schmidt in, and their antibodies sort of weren't sure they even wanted him, but eventually they became pretty tight bond and partnership. So I think part of it is that you want to have a lot of transparent information, you want to have a lot of transparent knowledge exchange, you want to have, you know, pretty good debate and discussion amongst everyone in your company. So because you're really trying to build as much leverage from your team and your network that sits around you that allows you to execute against your goals as fast as possible. And by the less information sharing you have, and sort of the pillars of little information, and you sort of hold it, you're not going to get the maximum out of your team and out of your organization. Right. And I don't think you'll necessarily thrive. So I think one of the key things through all this, whether you're on a big high telling everyone about your successes, but all of a sudden you go, holy shit, we lost the deal, and like we're not sure we're going to make payroll now this month. You know, everyone's going to know this stuff. You want to just get the collective knowledge necessary to help you solve all the issues, because you're not going to have all the answers.
Just to pick up on that, I mean, there's a million, the answer to your question is a book, right? I mean, it's like The Art of Entrepreneurship. There's a million and one behaviors. I think, frankly, a lot of it boils down to temperament rather than behaviors. But one behavior which I think is a common fault that I see amongst aspiring entrepreneurs and just somewhat, you know, to some extent people who've actually started businesses, is this, they feel like they need to keep their great idea secret, or they need to kind of, you know, they need to sort of to keep it to, you know, to sway you to secrecy, but they, you know, maybe they'll tell you half of it or whatever. I think that's a terrible, terrible mistake. There's like a handful of circumstances in which that's appropriate, and those are like vanishingly small. Like you've kind of actually come up with a genuinely brilliant idea that no one else has ever had, and it's just the IP alone is so valuable that you don't want to share it. Like that doesn't really happen, right? I mean, it probably does, but I don't know any examples. You can correct me. Much, much more often, the idea that you think is absolutely brilliant is a piece of crap, right? And you want to know that. You want to know that. So before you start, okay, you want to get as much feedback as possible. You want to be as open as possible. Don't worry about someone else stealing your idea. Like, everyone's got ideas, right? There aren't many people who can actually go out and execute on them. That's really the scarce resource. And the risk of like someone stealing your idea is vastly outweighed by the benefit of having access to smart people who are thinking through these things with you. At a key stage in the development of the company. So my one piece of advice I give any entrepreneur is talk to everyone and be as open, as free about your ideas as possible.
I think the key point there is that you have to believe that once you collect all the information necessary and you are going to go do something, that you can build the team and you can out-execute anyone else in it. And because there's the thing that's interesting about the marketplace today, we're a massively fragmented, you know, someone comes up with an idea, 10 other companies get launched right away that are very similar to it. And a very few of them will really pop to the top. And look at Twitter clients. How many Twitter clients are there? Tons. Like, no one's emerged as a major client yet. 15 to 18% market share is the biggest one. Something like that. So you look at it and you kind of go, there'll be tons of stuff out there. So the more information you have, I think you will, and learn how to process that in your company. More questions?
I think part of the problem with this is that, at least this is my view on it, is that if a lot of the startups, one of their key factors for success, is that they're trying to become a big company, and that's one of their key aims. So is it possible, or how possible is it to work for a startup where that isn't one of the key aims, so you can sort of maintain that culture? I'm thinking of social enterprise and that sort of thing, but obviously I'm sure there are other examples. I'd be interested to hear about those.
Well, I think there's a real, I mean, there's a lot of companies that come and that I talk to that I sit back and say, they don't need to raise money. They have an idea that might be a really good $5-8 million deal. They should find the right people in there. They could probably pay themselves huge amounts of money every year if they made themselves extremely profitable. But maybe it's not going to be a big thing. It's not going to be bought by someone else. But also it might be in a journey that takes them somewhere else. They don't know where the journey's going, right? I think Steve Jobs said one time, a long time ago with Apple, he goes, we're going somewhere, I'm just not sure where it is. And it's, you know, you might find that you can find these really interesting deals that are out there, or the companies to build that can be really successful, that actually might have a whole different kind of way of thinking about it. That you might just say, I want to pay myself $700,000 a year and get something going to a certain level. And you might build it at a certain level and you find, wow, this is great, I can find someone else to run it. You can go off and do something else. Is that some of that stuff?
I think it's a very good question and a key point. We get so, in Silicon Valley, it's probably, you know, the worst here, because everything revolves around this venture model, where that's, in a sense, just getting Sequoia to invest in your company. That's like the first milestone on a path to success for, you know, kind of the mindset. And I think, you know, you see so many businesses. I mean, my next business, if I ever do one, will not include venture capital. I will figure out something. It doesn't necessarily have to get big. You know, I'd rather have 15 people who I love working with, who are brilliant, creative, who I pay really well, and where, you know, than necessarily getting it to, you know, I've done the largest company I started, and when I sold it was 150 people. And, you know, it's just a very different, it creates a very different dynamic. So you can start an agency or a consultancy or, you know, a creative shop, and be incredibly successful with 5 or 10 people and have a lot of fun and learn a ton, for 5 or 10 years, and it doesn't, you know, and there's no model, and you can do that also within large companies to the point here. So there's no particular model, but be clear, to Brett's point, be clear about what your business model and objectives are. And you know, the challenge is when there's a misalignment between your capital structure and the way, you know, the expectations you set with fundraisers, et cetera, and how you want to run the business and execute. Because that's when I see a lot of, you know, ugly stuff happening is, well, I just want to keep this at 10 people and we're perfectly happy and we're paying ourselves good salaries. The guy who gave you $2 million to get started is not very happy because, you know, he has no exit. He doesn't have a payout. Unless you structured it as, you know, with that as the intent initially.
I have a company I helped a little while ago, and they raised about $8 million in venture money. They raised some angel round, which I was part of, and then they raised about an $8 million round. And they got to the size where they needed to raise more money. And what happened was they got to the point where they realized the next round, we sat down with them with a spreadsheet and created this model that says, okay, what kind of exit do you need to have to pay for this money you're going to come in? Right. And it freaked them out. When they realized now at the deal they had now, they could sell a company for maybe $80 to $100 million and everyone would be happy. They took this next round of money in, it was going to have to be $150 to $200 million. And then they're kind of going, do we lose control of our company? It's almost like what the role of VC is. Because then the VC's got to sit back and go, they'll put the money in because they believe in that team, but they're going to go, as soon as that team gets a little hesitant, they got to figure out how to get it to that level. So aligning all these incentives up and your thinking up front. That's why I said in an earlier panel is like, when you get involved in a lot of stuff, it's a lot of it's like a marriage. You're going to have this tight thing. And particularly when a lot of money's involved, if there's a divorce that's going to happen, it's going to be ugly.
And there's a dating relationship before that.
Yeah.
Full of somebody up here.
Or lust, in his case.
11 years of.
Yeah, I just want to add that basically, from my point of view, the differences between a dreamer and an entrepreneur is a dreamer just dream about an idea, never do anything about it. Entrepreneurs actually get their ass off and do something about it. But that's not my question. My question is, the panel seems to have a common experience of, you know, being a business owner or run a business before and then being part of a big organization. My question is that, do you actually enjoy it more having a product or services and can meet the bottom line of a bigger company? Or do you actually enjoy it more being an entrepreneur and having the responsibility of being the cash in at the end of the month and pay your 15 to 20 employees on a monthly basis?
I can tell you right now I'm enjoying what I'm doing a lot more than I was than what I was doing for the last 12 months before selling the company. And the primary reason is I don't have to think about fundraising. I am so relieved. If I'd been at this event 6 months ago, I would have been staking out the room as, okay, that guy, I don't know him, I got to get to know him because, he's a VC and I got to build that relationship and this guy. You're always thinking about your next round. I mean, you close your round of financing and you're starting to think about the next round of financing, right? You're always in that, the first shot was free and then you're hooked, right? And if you get it to profitability, you're still always worried about that next customer, about closing the next deal, et cetera. There was a point made that you can kind of get a little lazy in the large corporations, and you know now you're far removed from the revenue. That is probably true, but I think I'd say that the people I work with now work no less or care no less about what we're trying to accomplish than we did as a startup. I mean, I'm as passionate now about having a major impact. I mean, look, we've got a big competitor now, right? These guys are trying to do something stuff, and it's interesting. But, you know, I want 12 months from now, when we're back in this room, if we're back in this room, I want to be able to present you with something that basically says, okay, which one is it? As opposed to, you know, which is a lot of what happens today at the high end of the marketplace. Right? I mean, we have a challenge, a really exciting challenge, which is to build the next platform for, you know, the largest phone carrier in the world. And it's with a huge set of assets, et cetera. Don't try to pitch me on Android.
No, I want to challenge you. I was just wondering why you had an iPhone.
Because, you know what? Until we have a phone at the high end of the market, which I think is I have both, right? Yeah. This is a US number, this is a German number, et cetera, right? Yeah. But until we have a phone which does everything this one, because this one thing does some stuff that this doesn't, but until we have a phone that does everything better, I think it's good competitive research.
Absolutely, that phone I'm not going to deny.
So I want to somewhat challenge you on that because I, of course, you know, I'm,
I'm surrounded by people at a big company who are enormously passionate about what they do, work incredibly hard, and I hope I'm one of them. I mean, it's a huge privilege to be able to do what we do. Lots of people would trade places with me in a heartbeat. I love it, and I work all the hours and all the rest of it. But I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I care more about shipping a new Google product than I did about making payroll in my startup. I mean, it's a totally different experience. You know, when you've got a startup, you're in like a different.
Care more or fret more?
I don't know. Maybe it's semantics.
Not semantics. You see, passion for what you're doing. You see, in the situation, what I'm finding right now is I can actually focus a lot more of my creative energy on having an impact at a whole different scale than I could when I was a small company, and then I was caring a lot about the fundraising and the paying and the customers.
I think there's different stages of your life that you're going to draw upon these different experiences that are going to be beneficial. And I, as an entrepreneur, I didn't have the ability to ask 25 super intelligent people all about one particular problem and get that much feedback in the same way that I can now at Google. And I also, to your point, don't have to worry about where I'm going to buy lunch because the lunch is provided for me for free, which is an incredible privilege because when I'm an entrepreneur, I had to figure out how I was going to buy lunch. I was going to have to figure out who was going to give me some money to buy myself lunch and my employees. But I can say this to Rob's point is that probably the best feeling that I've ever had in my life is the first time someone handed me a check when I had my own business because I know that I earned it from my own blood, sweat, and tears. And it wasn't just a salary, whether I'd done well or not done well in the last quarter. It was actually because of the hard work I had done. So I'll probably go back to that sometime in my life. But I'm also deriving a lot of value from being at Google.
I guess to an extent, what I'm saying, I would agree with that. I'm questioning the premise that there's a continuum, right? That there's where you can become more and more and more entrepreneurial depending on the size of the business, and then kind of at the end of that is being an entrepreneur. I think being an entrepreneur is something completely different. To be honest, from anything that exists in the sorts of companies that we're talking about, Nokia and Google.
And I think that was when I talked to all my friends, I said the same thing, because when you're in that, it's all on your shoulders, all on your team's shoulders. Yeah. It's a much different kind of game. More questions? This is the quiet one
right here.
Oh, sorry. His hand is lagging.
Simple question. Can you give us some examples of entrepreneurial activities you were involved in at Google or Nokia?
There's a whole handful of examples I could give you from Google, actually, because we're often challenged with taking a new product to market. Or the way innovation happens at Google is there's small, very small teams of engineers that will sprout ideas, and ideas are sprouting from the ground up all the time. And the way that we work is we'll quote-unquote dog food our products, meaning if there's a certain critical mass of people in the company that actually take hold of this product and say it's working, then let's bring it to market. And that could be, Google News, it could be Android was purchased, but it could be any number of products that we have that we actually trial out internally. I mean, for instance, right now my Gmail, my corporate Gmail, I'm using a completely different Gmail than you're using because I'm dog fooding some new product and I have to figure out how to use it all the time on a daily basis, literally, where there's a new change comes in. A lot of times as well, I mean, I'm not on the on the engineering side, and nor is Rob, but we have to take the business sense of what the engineers have come up with and take our business sense and then apply it. So there's a lot of different examples I could give you where that's basically how innovation happens at Google, from the ground up, from within to out. And then we'll launch it and see how it goes and see whether the users actually appreciate it the way that we do internally and then continue to iterate.
I can give you a Google example, actually, because when they bought JotSpot, they took the team and they split them into three groups almost. Some of them went in to the Google Apps business. Joe Krause went in to do OpenSocial, which is really sort of Google login now, basically, sort of morphed into that. Graham Spencer was the CTO, went on and is doing the the Google platforms application stuff, and they basically have been empowered to kind of do all these kinds of interesting things with a lot of flexibility. And so I think that what's interesting is they pull these people and you can plug it into things. And I think in Google, what you want to do is find those right kind of groups to plug into, which is the strength of it.
I said Nokia, I think our device portfolio is about 60 new devices a year. And every device there's a competitive ecosystem where every device basically competes in the marketplace and in different segmentations and different markets. And they're only, it's kind of like almost like an investment strategy. They don't all win, right? Some of them do really well, some of them do okay, and some of them don't do well at all. So there's a very kind of entrepreneurial, competitive effort going on that level, every iteration of the devices. But I think that from a pure kind of, if I look at what we're doing right now internally, and I can't really speak about it yet, but there's a huge amount of sort of innovative, market pressures on the outside that's causing innovation and rethinking about business models, we've announced that we're moving towards a very strong sort of services focus for the business, and that's being built up from a relatively small business relative to Nokia's total bottom line today, to what we're hoping will grow to be a very successful and large business in the next 5 years. So I think the competitive marketplace is interesting, right? I mean, Google is basically trying to do the same in the mobile phone market that they did on the browser, which is they're trying to disintermediate the stack and kind of effectively give away hardware for free, in order to kind of, because they have this advertising model that they think they can ultimately capitalize on the devices as well. So that's creating whole new market dynamics. Apple's changed the market dynamics somewhat with their operator relationships and with their shrinking the computer and putting it on and adding a phone on a device, right? So I think there's a whole set of very interesting market dynamics that are happening that are creating incredible opportunities both for product, service, and business model innovation and entrepreneurship. And it's being nurtured, and from OPK, from the Olli Pekka, the CEO of the company, and now he's made it very clear that we are a company that has reinvented ourselves a number of times, and we are at a critical juncture right now in the world because the mobile world is exploding and the landscape is rapidly changing, and we're going to do it again, and it's exciting.
Yeah, I'll pass the microphone up. Otherwise, I'll get a lecture afterwards about being a poorly behaved American leading a panel.
I just wanted you to kind of talk or elaborate on.
I was able to take a vacation, which felt really good, my experience is I think somebody, I think he was maybe he was saying, Rob, that it's kind of more of a personality type or kind of motivational trait. I think that yes, you have certain luxuries like the free lunch, like and you heard it here. There is a free lunch. The ability to go home on the weekend and not necessarily take work with you if you have a family or if you decide that you needed some time off. And I think, by the way, that allows you to have perspective and charges you up in ways that in startups you sometimes can lose and can be a real detriment to your ability to execute and make wise decisions. But listen, I think it's about the personal commitment and decision you make. What I knew, having sold my companies three times now, this is the third time I'm personally selling my own company and moving into another organization. The first two times, I was miserable because I thought I was going to continue doing what I did before, and I thought I was going to be rewarded for doing what I did, what I was really good at doing, as an entrepreneur and a CEO of a small company. I thought I was going to be doing that again when I entered the big company. That's wrong, right? That's not what you're doing. If you do that, you get rejected. What you need to do is, as I was saying initially, is You need to sort of start learning and understanding the DNA of this entity that's just absorbed you and understand what makes them so successful in many ways. And then also understand where maybe there's some illness or some weakness in the system that you might be able to contribute to improving. And I see it as an ecosystem. Silicon Valley is an incredibly Darwinistic, you know, brutal environment for, as Brett was just saying, one idea pops up, 10 more, boom, like that. And now you're in a competitive landscape before you even like get going. Big companies have similar things, competitive dynamics, internal politics, all these kind of things. It's just a different flavor of the same thing. So if you can be successful in the open ecosystem, why shouldn't you be able to be successful internally? And I think another thing, you know, you talk about risk-taking, right, and about having a stable job. Well, if you treat a big company like a stable job, and you just sort of say, okay, I'm going to go from here to my pension, then maybe yes. Then it's kind of like, you know, not that entrepreneurial. But by the way, if you're entrepreneurial, you also have to risk failure. And if you fail real big in a big company, they'll probably kick you out, or they should kick you out. So, I mean, I could still fail miserably in this new role I have. And if I do, they'll kick me out. And that's the risk I'm taking. I'm not looking at my pension with Nokia. I'm looking at having a big impact just like I was in the marketplace. I'm looking at having a big impact within this organization. And I think if you take that mindset and you're still taking risks, just sort of different risks, you know, they might hate me a year from now because I do all the wrong things or I say all the wrong things, or, you know, and if they do, they'll, you know, I'll get booted out and do something else. And so you, just like in the marketplace, you push the boundaries to a certain amount, but if you push them too far, then you're just an arrogant asshole, or you're living in kind of an alternate universe. So you have to adjust within the ecosystem you operate in, and then try to, you know, be successful.
I think you're coming at this from the viewpoint of somebody who is a temperament and experienced entrepreneur making their way at different periods of your life in big corporations, and I think that's extremely valuable, but it's also very unusual. I mean, you know, most people don't have the luxury of doing that. I think far more often, perhaps speaking for maybe the people in this room, it's really a question of like, well, should I start my own business? Should I go work for a big company, as opposed to, well, I'm going to, you know, thinking about selling my own business to a big company and doing that. And it seems to me that yes, entrepreneurs can find a way of making a success. Most of entrepreneurs can work for big companies and try, you know, obviously depending on the company, but be entrepreneurial and sort of make their way through, because those skill sets that you pick up as an entrepreneur are extremely valuable to any company. But the reverse isn't true. The reverse isn't true. Most of the people I work with in you know, at Google, and this is just true of most of the people I know and most of the people that are out there, would just not make good entrepreneurs because they just don't have that instinct and that appetite for that risk. It's just like there aren't that many people out there who can really cope with what's required to be an entrepreneur. It's not easy. Most companies fail. You know, these Facebooks and the Googles of this world are wonderful as they serve as an inspiration to so much creativity, right? But they are the exception, right? They really are the exception. You show me an entrepreneur, and I'll show you a successful entrepreneur, and I'll show you someone who's had 5 failures, right? And so you have to be the kind of guy who can go through all those failures, and most people aren't like that.
So do we have any more questions? Or we're getting close, I think, to time. Any other questions? So I want to thank our esteemed panel here. And thank you guys all for coming. One of the things I suggest everyone is that, you know, you do have a lot of people have got a lot of experience. Sometimes people are shy to ask their questions, or they don't get their questions answered. I encourage you to be really aggressive with the talent that's here. Tackle them, do whatever you need to do to kind of figure out if you've got a burning question, get it answered. And in closing, I think if you do have a burning desire to be an entrepreneur, try it. You know, you're not going to regret it. And in fact, I think if you try it and you failed, what's really, I think, an amazing thing about Megan Smith told me, that works with these guys one time, and who I think, even though it's a big company, she works 24 hours a day and her arms are moving all the time. She could probably elevate herself.
It's in her DNA.
But I think that what she told me one time is what she loved about Google when she first got there was, we try to hire entrepreneurial people. Right, that's one of their thing. They like to find them when they get them. And I sort of think that if you've got it in you, try it. And even if it doesn't work out, something's going to come from it. You're going to find, if you're clever enough to get a company going, you're going to be clever enough to figure your way through it. And not everything's going to be successful. And hopefully, you're going to create great successes out of your failures. So thank you for coming.